There's a time for living. The time keeps on flying.
Beautiful, right? This is the Real BS Show.
Beautiful.
Coming at you. The Bill and Seth Show. Pretty nice music, huh?
Yeah.
We won't tell everybody who this is. We'll save it for later.
Yes. The artist that's singing this is somebody we're going to be covering.
Yeah, right. We're going to do a show about this guy. Now, I had a couple people mention doing a show like this.
Yeah.
I don't know if these are mass... What do you call them? Serial killers?
Serial killers, mass murderers, yeah.
I'm a serial killer. Yeah, I am.
You eat cereal?
A lot of mornings, I kill Cheerios and I kill Rice Krispies. Right. My favorite ones.
The Honey Smacks.
Starts with a C, though, not an S.
Yeah.
But, you know, after our last show from the Ukraine, it was so uplifting and so... It was really good music. I mean, that, you know, if you haven't heard it, you got to listen to it. Well, I know you heard it, but
yeah,
talking to the audience. And so I started searching around. Well, you searched around, too. You found some nasty ones. But boy, I tell you, it kind of turns your stomach after a while. You're trying to do all this research and everything and find something that's, I don't know, playable, I guess. And it explains things pretty well, you know. Because there's a lot of mystery around some of this stuff, but I think I found one.
Oh, yeah?
It's a little long. It's, I don't know, 35, 40 minutes or something. I don't know for sure. But it describes probably something that a lot of people don't even know. But I think in our serial killer series,
yeah,
we're going to lose all our audience.
Maybe.
But anyways, I think Charlie Manson would be a good place to start. A lot of people compared him to Hitler.
Oh, sure.
Christ. And, I mean, this is all over the map. Now, the guy died not too long ago.
Yeah, cardiac arrest.
In prison. And guess what? His assets totaled about $3 million.
Oh, yeah, I believe it.
So all these illegitimate kids or whatever showing up looking for the money.
I was shocked when I heard his music. I just couldn't believe what I was hearing. A lot of his music, some of it's really junk.
Yeah, some of the recordings are bad.
Yeah, and you could tell he's like really high. The ones that were good, like that one there, that was just superb. You know?
Yeah, it was kind of a nice recording. And the Beach Boys even stole one of his songs, and that's what ticked them off. And and he went to he wanted to take revenge on this Terry Melcher up there on Cielo Drive, and he screwed up because Melcher moved away a month before that and got the wrong folks. But he had other reasons too. So why don't we get into this? Because the record, like I say, the documentary thing is well done,
right?
And it explains things very well, and I'm sure a lot of people don't know. So. Our first killer on deck here is Charles Manson.
Sad, sad game.
The late 1960s were years of unprecedented emergence for America's youth. A time of freedom and awareness. A summer of love and a call to action. The birth of group consciousness and the sharing of a vision. By 1969, the burgeoning youth movement was at its zenith. Yet sociologists agree that it took but one man, in fact, one image, to bring the free-spirited psychedelic era to its knees. From the cover of Life magazine, the glazed, maniacal stare of this murderous, self-styled guru would serve to alternately beckon and repel the public senses for decades to come. Charles Manson had arrived. It has been said that true celebrity comes when the world knows you by one name alone. If that is the case, Charles Manson has undoubtedly entered the ranks of the immortal, not as a consummate entertainer, but instead as America's favorite boogeyman. More than 20 years after the series of gruesome murders that would assure him a probable lifelong imprisonment, the press and the public still appear to have a boundless fascination with this aging, diminutive sociopath who still appears regularly in magazines, on television, and in theaters around the world. Yet with a near-constant barrage of interviews and exposure, many questions regarding the life and crimes of Charles Manson have gone unanswered. The near-mythical status that Manson has acquired in the annals of violent crime seems curious when one considers that, in truth, he played no physical part in the savage butchery with which he will be forever associated. Yet Manson remains, by media standards, the undisputed king of the killers and the focus of a nation's nightmares and its wrath. How did he earn his preferred spot in the dreaded gallery of the all-time infamous? Perhaps the key to Manson's current complexity lies in his simple past. On November 12, 1934, in Cincinnati, Ohio, the man whose name the world would never forget ironically entered that world as No Name Maddox, the son of an unwed drifter, 16-year-old Kathleen Maddox. To escape the religious fervor of her domineering mother, Kathleen's youth was spent rambling through the back hills of Kentucky with her infant son in tow. To survive, she learned to accept the favors of a succession of lonely men, one of whom would lend the name of Manson to her fatherless child. Often, while his mother would haunt roadhouses and taverns, Manson would find himself in the care of various backwoods relatives. To this day, the moonshine-still explosion which killed his Uncle Jess remains one of Charlie's most vivid childhood memories. Kathleen's wanderlust eventually led her from state to state, but young Charlie had reached an age that was just too distracting to her new boyfriends. Their collective protests caused Kathleen to place the 12-year-old in an Indiana boy's home. The streetwise youngster, however, had grown quite accustomed to the ways of the road and soon began a cycle of escapes and recapture that would eventually land him in the famous boys' town of Father Flanagan. Yet after a stay of only 4 days, Manson and an accomplice stole a car and fled boys' town. This action resulted in Manson's first incarceration in a juvenile home, a grim foreshadowing of the decades of institutional life to follow. During his mid-teens, Manson's defiant nature made him a constant discipline problem for authorities, and often cruel methods of punishment were utilized to curb his stormy nature. His slight, frail appearance made him a ready target for the resident bullies as well. Another rash of bold escapes and careless car thefts would delay his release until 1954, at age 19. Soon Manson would marry, and after a brief, frustrating attempt to make an honest living, Manson and his pregnant young wife would leave for California in yet another stolen automobile. As fate would have it, Charlie would again be arrested and jailed, during which time his wife decided to pack up their newborn son and move on without him. Upon his release in 1958, Manson settled in Los Angeles and soon engaged in a series of remarkably petty, illegal endeavors. The forging of a $37 check, a few minor thefts, and even a bungled attempt at pimping on the back streets of Hollywood. Due to his previous record, the collective legal effect of these offenses was harsh, and Manson was soon serving a 7-year prison sentence, the final phase of which was spent at Terminal Island. There he would trade guitar licks with Alvin Creepy Karpus of the Ma Barker gang, and dabble in Scientology, a cultish self-help religion created by science fiction author L. Ron Hubbard. Manson actually grew content with his life at Terminal Island, and when finally facing release in 1967, he pleaded with officials to let him stay. This being a legal impossibility, Manson reluctantly ventured into a strange new world that had leapt a full decade forward. And now this unlucky, uneducated ex-convict, who had spent over 17 of his 32 years in complete confinement, was destined to spend the first months of his newfound freedom in a place where restrictions were virtually unknown. This larcenous, wayfaring hillbilly had stumbled upon the Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco during the very height of the psychedelic era. Here Manson reflects on the events of that time.
You guys blame me for the 60s. And then Jerry Rubin and A.B. Hoffman and Timothy Leary and Baba Ram Dass and all the Holy Morocco's, they all ran the other way when it got too nasty. They would tell their children, raise up and kill your mom and dad, but then when they raised up and killed their mom and dad, then all the people that said that ran. And then they blamed it over on me and said, oh, well, Charlie Manson's a hippie cult leader, and he made kids do all that. But none of them kids that got busted said that. It's like this, man. Back in the 40s, when I'd be on the basketball court, for example, and all the kids would say, hey, your mom's calling you, Billy. You know, so Billy would leave, and then John would leave, and Tom would leave, and I'd be out there sitting on the basketball smoking a joint. You know, and I was unaccepted. I was the outcast. So I ended up stealing a bicycle, and I went to reform school. And then I get out 10 years later, and I go back to the neighborhood, and I go back to the basketball court, and everybody's grown up, and there's a whole new wave of kids there. So we sit and we talk, and I say, whatever happened to Johnny? Well, he died in Korea. Well, whatever happened to Joe? Well, he's an automobile engineer in Detroit. And whatever happened to so-and-so? Well, he moved to Chicago. And then I steal a car, and I get a gun, and I go rob a few places. And then I come back out of prison after 10 years, and I go back over on the basketball court. And time for Johnny to go home, Johnny doesn't go home. And the basketball court, there's 10 or 15 kids, and it's all the way after dark. And what are you kids doing out after dark? Well, ain't you going to go home for dinner? Oh, no, my mom kicked me out of the house. My mom's a drunk. She don't like me. In other words, the last time I got out in 67, the road that I was walking on, hey, there's a whole bunch of kids walking on the same road. I said, well, I didn't know you knew this place. But when I heard Timothy Leary say, tune in and drop out, I knew where they were dropping out to because I had been on under that, on the under road, on the back side of what's happening, you know. In other words, in the darkness.
The widespread rebellious climate of this period would give rise to another sociological phenomenon that would almost single-handedly provide Manson with the power to sway young minds. For the radical youth, the collective ideal of the day was to topple the prevailing social structure. Hence, they would often hail common sociopaths, derelicts, and streetwise hustlers as fellow freedom fighters. In this spectrum, ex-convicts were particularly admirable, for they were honored veterans in the war to sabotage the workaday world, and, like martyrs, had suffered for their cause. Being essentially a transient, Manson had begun to frequent communal crash pads, where music, ideals, and meals were freely shared. His colorful jailhouse tales and unique style of guitar playing made him an instant hit with local teens. He was soon regarded as the area's premier streetwise sage, and rapidly adapted his appearance to fit this treasured new role. Prior to this time, Manson's knowledge of the drug scene was limited to occasional marijuana use nearly two decades earlier. Suddenly, he was thrust into a world of pills and peyote, hallucinogenics which pleasurably altered time and space and gave the user a distorted perspective of reality. This, coupled with the newfound sexual freedom that marked the era, created for Manson the notion that illegal activity was no longer necessary to obtain his needs. For the first time in his life, he felt truly alive, even celebrated, and vowed never to endanger his stay in this virtual Garden of Eden. In the course of Manson's wandering through the bustling hippie mecca of Haight-Ashbury, he would meet and soon share an apartment with Mary Teresa Bruner, who would be the first official member of what the media would eventually dub the Manson family. Bruner would often join Manson on his frequent jaunts, exploring the scenic California coast and meeting a variety of fellow wayfarers. Manson would soon acquire his first transportation, a Volkswagen van, not by theft, but through trading a second-hand piano that a San Jose reverend had given him. Charlie, in turn, seduced the reverend's lovely young daughter, Ruth Ann, who would later join his growing band of devotees. Manson's dispensing of honest hobo logic and his unfettered lifestyle would prove remarkably enticing to the many young girls he would encounter in his travels. At the beckoning of an ex-cellmate who had connections in the music world, Manson made a solo trip to Los Angeles. It was there he discovered another festive gathering place for free-spirited youth. A casual stroll through Venice Beach would yield one of his most loyal and tireless champions, a petite, freckled redhead named Lynette Frohn. On another excursion to Manhattan Beach, future murderess Patricia Krenwinkel would join this virtual gypsy caravan. However, upon their return to San Francisco, the ragtag group found the once peaceful demeanor of the Haight-Ashbury district giving way to a dark, dangerous new element. The rising tide of drug traffic in the streets had brought an influx of violence between rival dope pushers. rampant thieving and prostitution among local addicts. It's ironic, perhaps, that during this period of retreating peace and freedom, Manson would acquire his soon-to-be most destructive and notorious female companion, Susan Denise Atkins. Ironic, too, was the fact that after decades of having been denied any contact with the opposite sex, Manson now commanded a full troop of adoring females. Luckily, Manson was able to trade the cramped and obsolete van for an old but spacious school bus, which the girls cleverly converted into a stylish hotel on wheels. They eventually found themselves in Los Angeles, where word of this magical minstrel and his hippie harem became the talk of the underground Hollywood drug scene. Charlie was soon rubbing elbows with many of Tinseltown's elite, who were fascinated by his music and exotic lifestyle. The girls were wholly dedicated to having their mentor become a musical success and would dangle themselves like candy before a host of noted young record producers. This tactic generated an avalanche of promises, but only a handful of recordings.
There's a time for living. The time keeps on flying. Think you're loving, baby, and all you do. Crying, can you feel? Ah, the feeling's real. Look at your game, girl.
Manson's haunting compositions would attract the interest of some of the music industry's top stars. Many would choose to borrow elements of his sound and style, yet none would help to launch him as a performer. Despite his growing resentment of music industry methodology, Charlie remained a solid hit with the local Hollywood party scene, and before long had acquired many new traveling companions, including Diane Lake, Catherine Gypsy Cher, Leslie Van Houten, Kitty Lutzinger, Nancy Pittman, and the fiercely devoted Sandra Good. Several of these girls were also followers of another charismatic young musician named Bobby Beausoleil, whose boyish good looks had earned him the nickname Cupid. Although Manson had previously been reluctant to recruit male members, Beausoleil was allowed to join the group. Manson now felt that his ever-growing female legion would require more care and protection than he alone could provide. Soon, Manson's chance meeting with hard-living rock drummer Dennis Wilson led to a close personal relationship. Wilson delighted in the constant sexual favors of Charlie's girls and gave the group the run of his home and many of his personal possessions. The association ended abruptly, however, when one of Charlie's songs appeared uncredited on the Beach Boys' 2020 album. In the course of their travels, the group would pause to deliver Mary Bruner's child by Manson, who would dub the boy Pooh Bear. Due to the influx of new members, the cramped, road-weary school bus was no longer an ideal home for this youthful band of nomads. Having heard of a local wrangler who could repair the ailing bus, Manson paid a visit to his place of employment, the Spawn Ranch. This once popular Western movie locale had become a virtual ghost town, with only a portion of the property still in use as a horse rental service. The tall canyons and natural streams that bordered the ranch created the illusion of complete and natural isolation, though suburban Chatsworth was only minutes away. Manson's mind reeled at the prospect of settling his family in this remote and spacious squatter's paradise. To make matters more ideal, the resident owner, George Spawn, was 81 years old and legally blind. Spawn agreed to let Manson and his clan move in, and in turn would receive constant care and attention from the girls. To Manson's initial dismay, the sudden presence of dozens of scantily clad females on the premises brought several of Spawn's young hired hands into the fold. Soon, many of the male drifters the group had encountered on the road would turn up as well. Among these were Bruce Davis, Steve Grogan, Paul Watkins, Brooks Poston, and the young man who would later be the group's chief assassin, Charles Tex Watson. The addition of this decidedly rowdier element would make unwelcome demands on Manson, who had grown accustomed to the girls' unqualified adulation. Now the age-old tribal right of maintaining his stature among his own gender would later compel him to display unnatural courage in several volatile situations. During the first months, life at the Spawn Ranch had been an idyllic celebration of complete freedom and sharing. Each day, the girls would prepare communal meals made from the discarded produce of nearby supermarkets. Being that this remote rustic setting was devoid of societal restrictions, drug experiments and open sexuality became the chief entertainments of the group. Hence many births would occur in the months that followed, including yet another son for Manson himself by way of Sandra Good. Manson took exceptional pride in his ragtag band of outcasts. Unable to live within the confines of ordinary society, they had successfully created a world of their own. And although he had once been a faceless, voiceless member of a gray-clad human herd, he now found his every thought, every vision, eagerly devoured by his faithful young followers. To amuse them, Manson would often spin tales of revolution and society's violent end. The group continued to grow, and the inclusion of several members of the Straight Satan motorcycle gang made possible many nefarious methods for generating communal funds. With monumental profits pouring in from daily car thefts and drug sales, Manson had soon abandoned his vow to walk the straight and narrow, and two subsequent events would set into motion the collapse of Charlie's world. In June of 1969, naive Texas-born Charles Watson became entangled in a precarious dope transaction with a black Los Angeles drug lord. When vicious threats against the Spawn Ranch girls were leveled, Manson would intervene. And after a tense standoff, a scuffle would ensue, and Charlie shot his foe with a buntline revolver. Manson was furious with Watson over having been drawn into a shooting incident and told the cowering young Texan, "Now you owe me one." Although the drug lord had only been wounded during the dispute, by pure chance, the next day's newspaper reported the local murder of a prominent Black Panther figure. Manson was particularly unnerved by the item, having spent time in prison with many black militants whom he regarded extremely tough and dangerous. He recalled their boasts of stockpiling arms in the ghettos for an impending revolution and feared bloody reprisals on his Spawn Ranch family. A wave of paranoia swept through the residents of the ramshackle ranch, and for a while, the usual evening frolics were exchanged for weapon handling seminars and lookout duties. It was in this desperate atmosphere of unfounded fear and dread that the Manson tribe would graduate to its most damnable deeds. Gary Hinman was a 34-year-old music teacher who had been a steady supplier of drugs to the Manson family. When Bobby Boussoulet discovered that a high-priced purchase of the hallucinogenic mescaline was of a decidedly low quality, he took two of the girls to Hinman's Topanga Canyon home to demand a refund. Hinman became troublesome and was subdued and threatened by the trio for hours, to no avail. Boussoulet eventually called Manson and requested that he aid in settling the matter. Upon Charlie's arrival, Hinman expressed relief, assuming that his tormentors would now be called off. To convince the stubborn Hinman that paying his debt would be the wiser course of action, Manson resorted to bravado. He split Hinman's ear with a small sword and hurriedly left. The girls attended to Gary's wound and fed him, though the frustrated Boussoulet would soon begin a new cycle of unproductive threats. When the standoff ended its second day, nerves were frayed all around, and due to his now delirious state, Hinman suddenly began struggling and screaming for help. Reacting with a savage impulse, Boussoulet then descended on his hostage and fatally stabbed him. In desperation, the group would employ a gruesome device to help mislead authorities. The words "political piggy" were scrawled on the wall in blood, along with a panther paw symbol, to suggest the murder was the work of black militants. The girls then returned to the ranch while Boussoulet headed north in his victim's car. He was promptly arrested in the stolen vehicle and was soon being held as a murder suspect. Manson became frantic when he learned of the Hinman murder. He knew that soon investigators would link Boussoulet with the Spawn Ranch group, and his return to prison would be inevitable. Distraught over Bobby's capture and the incessant brooding of their leader, the girls devised a wicked plan, the committing of a random, look-alike murder, bearing all the same grisly elements, would undoubtedly bring about Boussoulet's release. Manson approved the scheme and selected Susan Atkins, who had been present at Hinman's murder, Patricia Krenwinkle, and newcomer Linda Kasabian to carry it out. Because he owed a debt of sorts to Manson, Tex Watson was appointed as leader of this drug-soaked death squad. The last hurdle would be the selection of an ideal murder site. Both Watson and Manson recalled a secluded, sprawling estate in Benedict Canyon, where they had visited Doris Day's record-producing son, Terry Melcher, some months before. They knew the current residents were certain to be high-profile Hollywood types that would generate a great deal of press attention. Manson instructed the girls to do whatever Tex told them. And with that, the youthful band of assassins slipped into the night. Sharon Tate was a lovely 26-year-old actress who had rapidly risen through the Hollywood ranks. She appeared in a succession of well-received offbeat films, including the classic horror spoof, The Fearless Vampire Killers.
Who says vampires are no laughing matter? They certainly are. Two men on a vampire hunt. Simple? They certainly are.
Sharon would soon marry the film's eccentric Polish director, Roman Polanski, who had created a cinematic sensation with his eerie satanic tale, Rosemary's Baby. By August 8th of 1969, Tate was 8 months pregnant with Polanski's child and spending a quiet evening in the company of friends. With Polanski in England on business, Sharon had invited ex-boyfriend Jay Sebring to keep her company. Sebring was an internationally known hairdresser to the stars, who was no stranger to the Hollywood fast lane. Also visiting that evening was Abigail Folger, the coffee heiress, and her virtual gigolo companion, Wojtek Frykowski, a known drug supplier to the industry in crowd. Upon arriving at the tranquil scene, Watson carefully clipped the phone wire outside the gate and led the girls up an embankment that would give them easy access to the grounds. In the driveway, they encountered 18-year-old Steve Parent as he prepared to leave after a visit with the guest house resident, groundskeeper William Garrison. Watson rushed Parent's vehicle, and through the window, he shot and slashed the helpless teenager to death. Having officially begun the bloody spree, Watson ordered Linda Kasabian to stand lookout near the gate, while the others eagerly proceeded to the main house. There they found Wojtek Frykowski napping on a flag-draped sofa. He was hastily awakened and bound up, and when he inquired of his captor, "Who are you?" Watson hissed, "I'm the devil, and I'm here to do the devil's business." The girls gathered Folger, Tate, and Sebring from other rooms in the house and led them to Watson, who attempted to truss them with rope from an overhead wooden beam. When Sebring protested on pregnant Sharon's behalf, Watson instantly shot him, setting off a panic in which Frykowski and Folger struggled furiously with the knife-wielding girls. Frykowski battled his way to the front porch, where Watson shot, bludgeoned, and stabbed him repeatedly until he expired on the lawn. Only yards away, Folger, too, had made a courageous break for freedom, but had been tackled and stabbed by Patricia Krenwinkel. Watson then joined Krenwinkel to aid in the killing of Folger. In the wake of this bloody pandemonium, a calm had now settled over the estate, and the killers re-entered the house to find Sharon Tate frantically pleading to Susan Atkins to spare the life of her unborn child. Instead, the heartless Atkins held her while the murderous monster Watson engaged in the night's final atrocity. In keeping with their plan, Atkins smeared the word pig on the front door in Sharon's blood before the group departed for the ranch. Upon arriving, they gave Manson a full report of the night's activities, and all retired to a sound sleep, except the haunted Manson, who feared this was too sloppy a job to suit their purpose. The following night, he would personally direct a death squad to its target and supervise the affair. On the night of August 9th, Manson would randomly select the home of grocer Lino LaBianca and his wife Rosemary as the next scene of mayhem. Manson led Tex Watson, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Leslie Van Houten into the house and instructed them to bind the hands of the frightened couple. To calm them, Manson offered assurances that they wouldn't be harmed, then hastily departed to allow Watson and the girls to begin their grisly task. The brutality and carnage that followed was reminiscent of the Tate slayings in every respect, with the additional gruesome element of Mr. LaBianca's corpse bearing the word war carved into the flesh of his belly next to a large protruding fork. Yet to the chagrin of the perpetrators of this senseless series of killings, the police perceived no immediate link to the murders of Hinman, Tate, and LaBianca. In a short 2-year period, Charles Manson had managed to completely betray the peace-loving ideal of his spiritual birthplace and was now a crazed, desperate figurehead to a clinging, murderous mob. Part 2 of our story explores Manson's exodus to Death Valley, his capture and trial. We'll also examine the fate of his past followers and the phenomenon of his present ones. The mysterious murder of Sharon Tate and her companions on August 8, 1969 caused a flood of fear in the Hollywood community. The sales of padlocks, guard dogs, and security systems skyrocketed overnight. In the press, theories abounded and many false leads would be widely publicized, further complicating the investigation process by police. The first suspect to be questioned would be the occupant of the guest house, William Garretson, who claimed he heard no screams or gunshots emanating from the main house that night. Sharon's husband, Roman Polanski, hurried home from his trip abroad and made an emotional statement to the press.
The house is open now. The police has released it. And you can see, you can go and see the orgy place. You will see innumerable books about natural birth, which he was planning. And I was hurrying home because apparently I had to go to some kind of school with her. I never understood what it was, but I had to be present at these lessons or whatever it was. But I was going along with anything she said.
Due to the confirmed drug use and rumored decadence of victims Frykowski and Sebring, the tabloids had a field day speculating as to the true nature of the savage crimes. Sharon Tate, who on film had repeatedly portrayed the epitome of despoiled innocence, would now be remembered as a classic case of life imitating art. Her funeral was lavish and attended by a Hollywood who's who. As a fitting final tribute to her image as a pop goddess, Sharon was buried in a designer miniskirt. Meanwhile, little progress was being made by investigators, who initially dismissed the LaBianca murders as the work of a copycat killer.
Actually, the homicides are not connected. I think the public and a lot of the media picked out the fact that they were similar in nature, possibly because of the blood and the inscriptions. But this is rather a common type of thing in homicides. We've had many cases before where the suspect is written in blood or in lipstick or various things of that nature.
Soon, Hollywood paranoia was so great that when the father of a popular singing quartet, the Lennon Sisters, was mysteriously murdered in an unrelated incident, Screen magazines hurriedly dubbed the collective slayings the Tate-Lennon murders. It was during this period of wild speculation, only 1 week after the brutal slayings, that a remarkable coincidence would occur. A newspaper headline would, once again, ponder the popular question, who killed Sharon Tate? Unbeknownst to all, the answer was very near. In the next column, a smaller article reported the arrest of a gang of suspected auto thieves. Acting upon a series of complaints regarding the unkempt residents of Spahn Ranch, a massive police raid was executed, and the entire group rounded up and arrested. As would often be the case, Charles Manson was the last to be captured and booked. However, the whole affair was little more than an inconvenience to the group, who would be released within 48 hours due to an improper search procedure by police. With the authorities now routinely monitoring the Spahn Ranch activities, Manson decided the ranch had become too hot for comfort. He also knew that one of the traits that his suburban-born followers had found most intriguing was his insistence on remaining an essentially natural being. His regard for the ways of animals, his adherence to a vegetarian diet, and his non-dependence on plug-in luxuries were emulated by the group. Manson would now put their hearty pioneer spirits to the ultimate test and move them to the hostile, barren environment of the Death Valley Desert. Previous to the planned exodus, Manson had secured permission to use an abandoned desert ranch from its owner, Arlene Barker, by trading a Beach Boys gold record that he had been given during his friendship with Dennis Wilson. The move from Spahn Ranch would not be without incident, however. A ranch hand, Donald Shorty Shea, who Manson was certain had initiated the police raid that ultimately made life intolerable in his macabre kingdom, mysteriously vanished. The journey to the sun-bleached sands of Barker Ranch was made caravan style, in a fleet of dune buggies and a school bus. The first days in the new setting were filled with adventure and wonderment, as Charlie and his troupe would explore the desert terrain, observing its odd creatures and marveling at its mysteries. However, this field trip atmosphere would soon give way to the realities of blistering heat and dwindling provisions, and several of the girls would soon register disenchantment with the monotony of their new surroundings. In an effort to revitalize family morale, Manson would direct a group in what he perceived to be an act of eco-terrorism, the ritual burning of an unmanned earth-moving machine that belonged to the Death Valley Park Service. This endeavor would only serve to step up Manson's impending capture, as furious rangers now decided to investigate the reports of a strange band of desert-dwelling hippies in the area. Meanwhile, Manson found himself in a more desperate spot than ever. He sensed that several of the lesser members of his tribe were prepared to defect, carrying with them varying degrees of knowledge as to the murderous misdeeds of August 1969. When Manson resorted to issuing threats and frequent displays of tyrannical rage, several of the group escaped to a nearby town and told the sheriff of their leader's descent into cruelty and madness. Once again, a major raid took place, with rangers and police rounding up the Barker Ranch gang. Manson was the last to be captured, having taken refuge in a tiny cabinet beneath the bathroom sink. When stolen vehicles were found on the property, the group was transferred to Indio County Jail for booking. During a routine interview there, Susan Atkins would display a perverse delight in tossing off cryptic references to the Tate murders. She was quickly transferred to Los Angeles, where she stunned authorities by happily recounting the details of the slayings in a nonchalant, breezy fashion. This news hit the national press like a bombshell and brought eventual murder charges against each of the Tate-LaBianca slayers, as well as ringleader Charles Manson. Along with Manson, Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Leslie Van Houten would be the first to stand trial for murder. At the time, the most bloodthirsty member of the group, Charles Watson, was being held in his native Texas and was initially spared prosecution by a lengthy extradition battle. Vincent Bugliosi, the chief prosecutor in the case, had found an ideal ally in Linda Kasabian. Kasabian, who had acted as a lookout on the night of the Tate slayings, was granted immunity in exchange for her testimony against her former associates. Bugliosi knew that in order to get a conviction for Manson, he would have to prove that he was the absolute architect and director of the Tate-LaBianca murders. He sought out several of the frightened and disillusioned ex-members of the group and interviewed each at length. From this vast pool of information, Bugliosi would construct for the jury a portrait of a paranoiac, antisocial tyrant who was intent on igniting a race war and believed the British music group The Beatles were sending him hidden messages through their music.
Well, this was a definition of Helter Skelter that that Charlie gave. Now, if you look at this white album, it's a Beatles album, there are many other songs. One of them is called Sexy Sadie. Sadie Glutz, also known as Susan Atkins, whatever you want to call her, she thought that the Beatles named this song after her. There's also a song called Piggies. There's also a song...
What is it in the Helter Skelter song?
Nothing particularly in that song right there, except the definition that Manson gave of it. There's another song in that same album called Blackbirds, talking about blackbirds fixing their wings and rising up. Charles Manson said the blackbird meant the black man.
Various elements of the public reacted differently to the strange tales that were abounding. For the hippies, the nonviolent purveyors of peace and love, every dismal revelation of the trial would sound a distinct death knell for their movement. Ironically, mainstream America was just beginning to lay aside many of its misgivings about the Flower Children. For years, hippies had been depicted by film and television as a comical and thoroughly harmless entity. However, the infamous cover of Life magazine, coupled with the sensational daily accounts of drug use and murder, would send a collective chill through the suburbs of America, and suddenly hippies weren't cute anymore. Manson was now viewed by the hippie movement as the guy who spoiled the party. On the other hand, young extremists and radicals generally viewed the Manson trial as the governmental railroading of a bold social reformer. Underground newspapers and comics would portray Manson as a visionary, a philosopher, and a martyr. The well-circulated Legion of Charlie's comic ran panels paralleling the Tate murders to the Vietnam massacre at My Lai and expressed satirical outrage at the system's handling of each. Headshop sold a variety of pro-Manson items, some comparing his plight with that of Jesus Christ. A collection of his recordings made exactly 1 year prior to the Tate slayings was distributed as well, bearing a graphic which openly mocked the famed Life magazine cover. But the overwhelming reaction of the general public was one of universal fear and distaste. The still loyal members of the Manson clan would keep a curbside vigil outside the courthouse, occasionally causing a circus-like atmosphere to prevail. Meanwhile, in the courtroom, news reporters feverishly struggled for a glimpse of or statement from the accused.
I don't accept the whole situation. You know, like I was in the desert minding my business. This confusion belongs to you. It's your confusion. I don't have any confusion. I don't have any guilt. I know what I've done, and no man can judge me. I judge me.
What have you done, Charlie?
I've stayed in the desert and run with the coyotes and ate off the plants and found out you could live out there without this society. And that's where I'd like to go live, you know. But you won't let me go, will you?
You don't know anything of society?
Pardon?
You don't know anything of society now?
Owe them anything? I've paid them 22 years of my life. You know, I'm the other end of your society. You know, so you can ride your bicycles and do your thing. I live in your reform schools and your orphanages.
Are you
I'm
bitter,
not
Charlie?
Against you. I'm
you
not
bitter?
Against you. Huh?
Are you bitter?
Bitter? No.
But
no.
You feel you've paid some price so far in your life.
Price?
To society. You said it.
Yeah, okay.
Does that make you bitter?
I don't know what that means.
How do you feel right now? Do you feel good feelings towards the judge?
I feel a little nervous. A little nervous. I feel good feelings towards everything. I feel no bad. I know no bad.
Okay, gentlemen, that's about it.
As the trial progressed, there would be countless disruptions, the most notable being the highly publicized mid-trial sentiment expressed by then-President Richard Nixon that Manson was guilty. This statement would create havoc in the court, when Manson sprang from his seat and revealed the headline to the jury. The underground press had a field day, and the trial was delayed while each juror testified that the president's statement would not influence their decisions. As the outlook for the defendants grew increasingly bleak, Manson employed physical symbols to reflect his ordeal. He slashed an X into his forehead and declared that he had X'd himself from society. The remaining Manson clan, both inside the courtroom and out, would immediately do the same. Later, Manson would shave his head to illustrate his role as a condemned man, and again his devotees would follow suit. These last desperate acts to generate attention to their plight would not serve the group, however, and after a landmark year-long trial, the defendants were all found guilty of murder and sentenced to death. Upon his eventual extradition to Los Angeles, Charles Watson, too, would be convicted and given a death sentence. A subsequent court action addressing the disappearance and suspected murder of Spahn Ranch wrangler Donald Shorty Shea would result in the conviction of two more family members, Bruce Davis and Steve Grogan. In the years that followed, Manson would serve time in many of the nation's most noted correctional facilities. Being an old hand at prison procedure, he quickly settled in and began an endless string of candid interviews with a still curious press.
It's like this. A guy comes up to you and he's called the district attorney. He's got all these guys and he handcuffs you and he sets you down. And he says, you're going to play this game whether you want to play it or not. So they start dealing out cards and they deal you hippie cult leader. You don't know what a hippie cult leader is. There's never been a hippie cult leader. So you got to go find out what a hippie cult leader is. You know, you say, all right, I got a hippie cult leader card. I got 9 murder cards. I'm supposed to be responsible for making all these people do all these things. I'm supposed to have this awesome power to move people to destruction and have the power of the presidency that I can put troops in the field and have them go out and fight and die and take other people's lives for me. I'm a whole government by myself, convicted to be that. It's like I told the judge, I know, God knows, and the Holy Spirit knows. And what you're selling down in the marketplace, your children are going to have to work that off. So I would suggest you not sell them a whole bunch of lies, you know, but they continued to sell that damn helter-skelter trip that had nothing to do with me. You go to court in this country, and it says they're not interested in why you did it, they're interested in if you did it. But why you did it should be an issue also. why are the children doing what they're doing? Why does a child reach up and kill his mom and dad and murder his two little sisters and then cut his throat? You know, why would a child do something like that? Because we're not raising it upright. We're programming it poorly. Our TVs are murdering people every 15 minutes. You see two or three people dying on TV. To the generation of the 60s and 70s, well, the TV's raising the children. The TV's their mom and dads. Now, I'm going to tell you something that you're not going to like, and probably the world ain't going to like, but I'll tell it to you just like it is. I was raised to ride my own beef. If I do something, I'm responsible for my own actions. If I bust somebody in the mouth, I'll stand up to that. I won't back off of that. If it means my life, I will give my life for my principle. It's that simple. If I wanted to, had it been me up in this Sharon Tate's house, it would have been a lot worse. Thank God that your children did it for you, and I didn't get started on it, because if I'd have got started on it, it would have been a lot worse than it was. And I would be justified in doing it if I did it with my life, and I gave my life for that, just like those children did. The dispensation of truth is not a difficult thing, and most children can understand it. If you're willing to give your life for something, you go and you pick up your uniform, you get your M16, you put your helmet on, and you get in that jungle, and you do what your country tells you to do. If you don't, then there's nothing, you're not there. There's nothing to you. Because all a man is honor. If he has no honor and he has no truth, he has no faith, he has no trust, what is he? He's a jellyfish, you know? But this country is overprotective of its people. It's always, in other countries I haven't found this to be so, but in this country, they don't want you to do this because they're afraid it'll hurt you. Come on. They're afraid it'll hurt you. That's like mother saying, don't climb the tree, you might fall and hurt yourself. Well, she might fall and hurt herself because she couldn't climb the tree. But you're a kid, you can climb the tree. You see what I'm saying? In other words, the older people have always put their values off on the younger people. And it's just the same old process that it's been since time began. The younger people keep throwing it off. And that's what the kids did in this, down there in L.A. They threw that all off of them. They want to get their brother out of jail.
In 1972, California abolished the death penalty, thus reducing the sentences of the Tate-LaBianca slayers to life imprisonment. With the prospect of parole before them, Susan Atkins and Charles Watson each proclaimed their spiritual salvation at every turn.
About the change that has taken place in their life, about what Christ Jesus can do to a person and saving that person and healing that person from the inside out.
Do you recall who stabbed who?
Yes, I recall basically who stabbed who.
Could you elaborate on that?
Yes, I could. As the records show, I did shoot Steve Panner when I went into the estate. I did stab Jay Sebring after he was shot by myself. As far as me taking the lead role, I was the male at the crime. But at that time, I did not consider myself a leader. I considered myself more of a follower of Charles Manson in carrying out his orders.
Charles Watson would be allowed to marry while in prison and was granted routine conjugal visits with his new bride. In this manner, the one-time cruel and savage fiend who had disallowed Sharon Tate her right to motherhood, has become the proud father of three. Perpetually outraged by the lenient treatment of her daughter's killers, Doris Tate has waged a tireless personal campaign to keep Atkins and Watson behind bars. Her emotional testimony at each of their parole hearings has proven quite effective to date, despite a mind-boggling recent development in which the daughter of Charles Watson's victim, Rosemary LaBianca, announced that she had faith in his alleged reformation and would like to see him freed. In addition to the inevitable autobiographies by those directly associated with Manson, over the years there have been a multitude of other diverse and bizarre literary impressions of the case. the published love letters of a longtime pen pal, a portrait of the Manson women by a female therapist who states they have only themselves to blame, a maudlin plea for Christian forgiveness by the wife of a Manson juror, and the thoroughly absurd crackpot theory alleging that Manson was one of a number of satanic hitmen linked to the New York murders of David Son of Sam Berkowitz. The grisly revelations made during the sensational Manson trial also generated a rash of exploitation films depicting maniacal gurus directing teenagers in orgies of lust and murder. Some of the films would go so far as to make specific references to the Tate slayings in their promotional campaigns. Eventually, television and even theater would cash in on the Manson phenomenon, and by the mid-1970s, the entertainment market had been well saturated with tales of Charlie and his followers. Without the promise of new developments, the material was becoming too familiar to audiences. Perhaps it was the fear that the interest in the Manson cause would die without a fresh headline that prompted ever-loyal Lynette Squeaky Fromm to action. In 1975 in Sacramento, Fromm would capture national attention by pointing a handgun at President Gerald Ford.
The president came down the walk and everyone was shaking his hand, and he came up to me and he shook my hand, and all of a sudden he grabbed away, and all of a sudden the Secret Service men were on this girl that was standing 2 people away from me. The girl standing next to me fell to the ground, and the next thing I know, they were rushing the president off, and they had in custody this girl that had supposedly had a concealed weapon in her purse.
There was no shot fired?
No shot fired.
I saw a hand coming up behind several others in the front row, and obviously there was a gun in that hand. I then saw almost instantaneously very quick and very effective action by the Secret Service in taking care of the matter.
Fromm would again make news on Christmas Eve 1987 with a 48-hour escape from Alderson Prison in West Virginia. Her role as chief spokesman for the Manson clan has changed little over the years. She's one of the most vocal champions of Charles Manson's grassroots environmental movement, ATWA, dedicated to the preservation of air, trees, water, and animals. In recent months, longtime Manson devotee Sandra Good has been the driving force behind a valiant fight to save Vermont's Lake Champlain from the ravages of paper mill toxins. It is perhaps difficult to imagine that ecological awareness would be a chief concern of a man who has spent 3/4 of his life in cages of concrete and steel. Yet it is precisely this enigmatic nature that has made Charles Manson a source of endless fascination to broadcasters, the press, and the public alike. By the 1980s, a new wave of youth culture had blossomed in America. More irreverent than ever, and often content to view Manson as a political prisoner or a folk hero. A generation who had never responded with shock and horror to the news of the Tate murders could now happily pursue Manson's image in trendy novelty shops on a variety of items. Buttons, gum cards, records, posters, and especially t-shirts. Weekly supermarket tabloids have also repeatedly explored Manson's legacy on both factual and highly dubious terms. And in the modern-day art community, Manson's mythos abounds in innumerable works, many of which depict him as a classically heroic figure. But the artwork that is most prized among the new cult of Manson admirers is that of Manson himself, whether it be bootleg recordings of his music made in his prison cell, or sketches and colorful string art figures made from the yarn in his socks.
It's play a game like a game I'm playing each day. I got 1,000 years on the tears of fears keep driving my convict's mind in the old way, and it goes just the same. Better get on board.
To this day, the whereabouts of many of the original Manson family members is a profound mystery. We know, however, that some went on to further adventures. Some choose to remain reclusive. One has died of cancer, and to date, one convicted murderer has been paroled. Curiously, Charles Manson has adopted the swastika as his personal symbol of harmony and perfect order, though his surroundings of the past 20 years have provided little of either. In the press, Manson has remained the yardstick by which all evil is measured, a hypnotic seducer of souls, a relentless destroyer of wills. Perhaps therein lies the element we fear most about Charles Manson. He, like no other murderous menace, invites us to fear ourselves.
This is the Real BS Show. So what did you think about that long dissertation?
That was a very excellent way of describing it.
Yeah, they nailed it as far as getting all the details in there. I think I found a nice little segment. It's not very long, but it has the ladies that really did all the damage,
mm-hmm.
Actual damage, I guess you could say. It has their take on what happened, and they get to talk a bit. And I think it'd be fair to put them on, too, you know, to...
Right.
I think it's only 8 to 10 minutes long, someplace in there.
Yeah.
So let's do that, and then at the end we'll chop in or drop in and say goodnight and end with one of Charlie's more famous songs. Not that I want to promote his music or anything.
No.
Please don't buy his music. Well, Charlie's gone now, so he's
it's his estate.
All the kids that think they're his kids are fighting over it.
Yeah.
All right, let's do that.
The Summer of Love. You didn't have to be a weatherman to know which way the wind was blowing when an estimated 10,000 hippies and hangers-on showed up for the concert in the Panhandle section of Golden Gate Park.
To understand how Manson did what he did, we have to understand the context of the time and place.
Demonstrators took to the streets.
A time in American history, you've got Vietnam, you've got the race riots.
6 days of rioting in the Negro section of Los Angeles.
It seemed anything was possible, both wonderful and terrible.
If you're going to San Francisco.
If you're going to San Francisco, it becomes a huge hit. And what it is an advertisement for the Summer of Love in San Francisco.
By the end of the Summer of Love, 75,000 people, they are descending on Haight-Ashbury, yet everybody's got there because of this belief, we're going to change the world. And this draws a lot of broken kids from all across America. And here's Charles Manson, the ultimate predator.
And so just as Manson is released from prison in California, the movement is like a magnet for all these people whose particular characteristics make them highly vulnerable to the thing that Manson has, the ability to manipulate.
People tend to think that only oddballs ended up following Manson, and that's not true. Leslie Van Houten's a great example.
And so she got wrapped up into that. And evidently this whole situation was love to begin with, but it didn't end up that way.
Diane Sawyer talks to Manson's ex-followers.
He was the first.
And in these extraordinary interviews, they attempt to describe how their middle-class personalities were overtaken by Manson's charisma.
Leslie in high school, very bright. She's gorgeous, all the boys love her. She plays baritone sax in the marching band, for gosh sakes.
Leslie Van Houten is an example of how people can be very normal, but they all of us have vulnerabilities, and Manson could smell it.
I seem to want more living out of life than what was expected of young girls at that time. Drugs, sex, you know, breaking away from the norm.
Leslie Van Houten's father moved out. She lost her way after that.
I think that when my father left, I was desperately seeking someone that I could love and hold on to and call my own.
Charlie Manson would always tell her little puzzles to try to work out. So he would say, you can figure this out. You're smart. He always finds the way to make the other person feel loved, appreciated.
He was like Christ, and he had the answers. For as twisted as it all got, you know, I really think that I felt that I had met someone that, by being around him, would have a positive change.
I don't think anyone ever joined the Manson family who completely were self-confident. He could always find a way in. Manson met Patricia Krenwinkel when she was staying with a sister who had problems. Manson said to Pat, "You should come away with me. You're so ugly, and I'm ugly. We're the only two people who will tell each other we're beautiful."
That night, we slept together. And when we made love, all I remember is just crying and crying to this man because he said, "Oh, you're beautiful." I couldn't believe that. I just started crying.
Pat Krenwinkel basically left with Charlie Manson the next day. And Pat firmly believed that she was going to leave with Charlie and he was going to be her new boyfriend. Imagine her shock when she found out she was only part of a harem and would have to share him.
He had great confidence in his own sexual prowess.
"And what they really liked about me, you want to really hear it?
Yeah.
Real good."
So he'd break people down, build them back up in his image, and they would become essentially fingers on his hand, subject to his every direction.
These kids were putty in his hands.
You know, it didn't happen overnight. He spent a lot of time taking middle-class girls and remolding them. I was an empty shell of a person that was filled up with Manson rhetoric.
It wasn't so strange in 1967 to drive a bus, to give up all your clothes, you know, and going around and talk peace. A lot of times where you might have had someone say, "Don't you think what you're doing is odd?" Instead, we were always in places where people were saying, "Wow, can I join you?"
The posse gets bigger and bigger, and eventually they all pile in that bus and they drive down to Los Angeles from San Francisco, where they settle at Spahn Ranch.
The Spahn Movie Ranch, which is in the northwest part of LA.
All the cowboy shows from the 50s and early 60s were shot there. The saloon, the hotel, the dusty Main Street.
Manson and his family just moved in there, and that became their base of operation.
For Manson, like any demagogue, if you're trying to take followers and make them buy into your reality as opposed to anybody else's, you want to get them isolated. You want to get them away from outside influence.
I was cutting off my past, and in my own brain, it was like, I can't go back.
You could absolutely not talk about your past at all.
And one thing we didn't have is watches. The whole idea was to let time disappear. There was no time.
We gave up our birthdays.
Squeaky Fromm was another young girl with parental issues. Charlie found her weeping on a bench outside Venice, California one day, introduced himself as the man who's called the gardener because he tends to all the little flowers in Haight-Ashbury and that she should come with him, and she did.
And I kept thinking, this is fate. Because he's exactly what I was looking for.
And love is infinitely strong and infinitely mad. It's erratic and crazy.
People have described her to me as, among all Charlie's followers, the greatest true believer.
She's a little more of a performer, maybe, than the other people in the family.
You have to make love with it.
She's very verbal. She has a certain childlike quality that kind of endears you to her until you listen to what's coming out of her mouth.
So that you could pick it up any second and shoot.
People who met him wanted to be like him. Men, especially, wanted to have that kind of charisma. So they would do the things that he did, but they didn't do them with the same spirit.
Drugs were always an important part of Charlie's appeal. In those days, the enlightened culture was using drugs. You honestly believed that smoking marijuana, taking LSD, would open up your consciousness.
I was smoking a lot of marijuana hash, and I had, at that time, I've already used acid a couple times, but at that time, drinking and using drugs did not seem unusual because I was doing it with my high school friends.
Charlie would use LSD for his special ceremonies on a daily basis where he would preach to people towards the end of the day.
Well, we took hundreds of trips together.
He would personally put the dosages in his followers' mouths. But when he took some himself, he was careful to take less so he'd stay in control. Sometimes he'd claim he was Jesus Christ, come again. He even would take up positions as though he was being crucified.
Sometimes he would reenact the crucifixion when we were on LSD. And it was very realistic. And then make the connections of man, son, son of man, you know. And then the questions would begin, would you die for me?
And in their drug-induced situation, they listened. So he used LSD as a form of mind control.
There was at times basically group sex, but it was always very planned because it was a means of control. When he'd have different men that he was trying to initiate into the family, try to bring them in, he would offer them whatever women he had.
Isn't that what women's for? Women receive men and reflect men. Man hold dominion up over woman. It's been that way since we grunted and we came out of caves.
If a man wanted you, you went with him. You couldn't resist. I mean, he was an excellent pimp.
Manson deliberately sent out the women in the family to go around and troll for famous musicians. They were the bait. That's how Charlie meant to use them.
He thinks he's going to be a singer-songwriter like Bob Dylan or like Neil Young. And what he finds is something very different and something that fuels his anger towards society.
There's a time for living. The time keeps on flying. Think you're loving, baby, and all you're doing is crying. Can you feel? Are those feelings real? Look at your game, girl. Look at your game, girl. What a mad delusion, living in that confusion. Frustration and doubt, can you ever live without game? The sad, sad game, mad game. Just to say your love's not enough. If on you can't be true, you can tell those lies, baby, but you're only fooling you. Can you feel? Are those feelings real? Look at your game, girl. Oh, look at your game, girl. If you can't feel and the feelings ain't real, then you better stop trying or you're gonna play crying.
This is the Real BS Show coming back at you. Well, I don't know. This whole thing is, I mean, if you start looking up for serial killers or, you know, mass murder and all that stuff.
It's a rabbit hole.
I tell you, there is so many. But the news media, even President Nixon got on TV and said, Charlie's guilty.
Right.
And the trial was going on at the time. I mean, they had to stop the whole thing and try to wipe the jurors' minds away from what Nixon was saying. I mean, mm-hmm. What kind of lawyer is that? I mean, geez. So, I mean, the news media, the magazines, and it just went nuts. I mean, T-shirts and buttons and, you know, they just went crazy with it, you know. I guess it had its own unique flavor or something, but, boy, they just blew it up something awful. And I don't know. He was interviewed till the day he died, I think. And it's kind of a sad way to run the show, I guess you could say. But a lot of people tried to make a buck off it, you know, and that's about what it was.
Right.
So what are we going to end with?
We could end with two different songs. I think they contrast each other, that's for sure. And
the best and the worst?
Yeah, worst and the best. I mean, this is just objective. You know, it's our, you know, someone might enjoy this song, but we have to remember the man was mentally ill. So he had some bright moments that were like, geez, he could have had a record deal. And the other ones were like, what is he doing?
Too many drugs.
Yeah, yeah. You know, well, hey, you know. Anyhow.
No, he was having fun. No, I guess sure. That's the main thing. well, what? Let's play the good one first, and then save the bottom one for last.
Oh, okay, that sounds good.
And we'll say goodnight to everybody and sweet dreams. You can go to sleep to this music.
Oh, sure.
This is this will put you right to sleep.
Yeah,
rock you to sleep.
Yeah.
Okay. You got them all set up, ready
to
go?
That's right, sir. I do.
Okay.
Well, I woke up this morning, grabbed my shoes, way out wrong. The news, I looked in the paper, first thing I saw, my baby bent down to see the law. She done turned me in. She done turned me in. Yes, my baby done left me, and she turned me in. Oh, well, it came down again to about a quarter to eight. The pay was running just a fraction late. I had it for the tracks and a hell of a rush. Someone said, baby, better hit the brush. She done turned you in. She done turned you in. Oh, yes, your baby done left you, and she turned you in. Now, if you got a baby, better treat her nice. With your brother, she'll stink your eyes. I send you up the river for 5 or 10, and you can take my word, she'll turn you in. She done turned you in. She done turned you in. Oh, yes, your baby done left you, and she turned you in.
Oh, garbage dump, oh, garbage dump. Why are you called a garbage dump? Oh, garbage dump, oh, garbage dump. Why are you called a garbage dump? You could feed the world with my garbage dump. You could feed the world with my garbage dump. You could feed the world with my garbage dump. That sums it up in one big lump. When you're living on the road, and you think sometimes you're starving, get on off that trip, my friend. Just get in them cans and start carving. Oh, garbage dump, my garbage dump. Why are you called my garbage dump? Garbage dump, my garbage dump. Why are you called my garbage dump?
There's a Market Basket and a AMP. I don't care if the box boys are standing me. I don't even care who wins the war. I'll be in them cans behind my favorite store. Garbage dump, oh, garbage dump. Why are you called a garbage dump? Garbage dump, oh, garbage dump. That sums it up in one big lump. I claim all these garbage dumps in the name of the garbage pickers of America. Garbage pickers of America. But it smells. Oh.